Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, the big screen is back, baby. That's one takeaway from Top Gun Maverick's tiny 30% or so drop on its second weekend, the smallest drop ever for a film that grossed more than $100 million on its opening weekend. The $90 million grossed by the Legacy sequel marks the eighth best second weekend of all time. And just one more stat to drive home how much money this is. Since the start of the pandemic, only 22 films have grossed more during their entire domestic run than Top Gun Maverick grossed in its second weekend. I'm sorry, just one more stat. $90 million is actually also $17 million more than Morbius grossed during its entire domestic run, which means that Tom Cruise is Morbin right up to the top of the box office. Morbius memes are back. All right, as I noted on Twitter, over the last 6 months at the domestic box office, we have seen the biggest Spider-Man movie ever. We've seen the biggest Tom Cruise movie ever. And we've seen the biggest movie from indie studio A24 ever. What this suggests to me is that people from every quadrant, you got men, women, young, old, etc., are headed back to the theaters if there's something worth seeing. But what is that something? Allow me to suggest that one factor in play with all of these movies is that they are all big, crowd-pleasing flicks that sent audiences home with a smile. And that resonates on a level deeper than simply cheering for airplanes, you know, doing crazy things up in the sky. As Derek Robertson put it in Politico, quote, "After years of Twitter, Trump, COVID, social upheaval, and an ever more bland, oppressive pop cultural sameness, a large number of Americans are desperate for permission to collectively feel good about our life, country, and culture without any of the attendant political baggage," end quote. Of course, what constitutes political baggage depends on your point of view. The commie firebrands at Jacobin decried Top Gun Maverick as, quote, "another military recruitment video disguised as a movie," end quote. They said this like it's a bad thing. Who could imagine such a thing? This is probably also why conservatives at outlets like Breitbart and The Daily Wire have cheered the film. They're saying it's pro-America, it's anti-woke, finally, stuff for the folks on the right. And progressives, of course, were quick to assure people that actually Top Gun Maverick isn't conservative at all. As Jesse Hassinger put it in The Guardian, quote, "No, Top Gun Maverick's success isn't down to being pro-America and anti-woke." He mansplained. All right, so there are two movies that box office guru Scott Mendelson compared Maverick to directly. Movie the first, Passion of the Christ. Movie the second, American Sniper. Both of these explicitly are coded in the public conversation, I think it's fair to say, as conservative. And while I would hesitate to say that, you know, this movie, Top Gun Maverick, is doing well because it's conservative, though, you know, I think there's a fairly reasonable way to code, you know, the bombing of an Iranian enrichment facility as a conservative thing.
Wait, the Iranians are the enemy?
Definitely
I
Iran.
Missed that line.
Definitely Iran. This is the people who want to say it's not Iran are the same people who refuse to recognize that President Whitmore is a Republican. But we can discuss that on another show. I don't think it's a coincidence to say that this movie is bringing out audiences regardless of political persuasion, shall we say. But Peter, what do you think, right? Is Top Gun Maverick a big hit because it's militainment agitprop of the best sort, or because it's sending audiences home with a big old smile on their faces?
Well, I think it's more the smile, but I don't know. I think this is an unusual instance because people have made this movie a cause, right? It's something a little, it's become something that is a little bit more than a movie, right? There's a sort of a movement here. It's like that line from Batman Begins: "If you make yourself more than just a man, if you devote yourself to an ideal, right, then you become something else entirely," right? Like, this movie has become something else entirely. And in some ways, like, it has gone beyond the movie itself. And I think it's also gone beyond nostalgia as well. And that's, you know, obviously part of it. Like, there is my colleague Matt Welch has talked about the way this movie taps a particular kind of like a reservoir of deep nostalgia for Gen Xers in particular, you know, who many of whom were high school students or, you know, 20 years old or so when the first Top Gun came out. And like what he said was, you know, it's like this movie like just represents like all the life you've had since then, right? 35 years or 36 years or whatever it is, you know, since you were in high school and now you're in your mid 50s and oh my gosh, so is Tom Cruise. What's going on? It's right. It's become like a vehicle for looking back on the whole second act of your career and what you've been through and all of that. And I also think there's a bunch of sort of post-COVID sort of like people had some bad times over the last 2 years. I mean, I say that as somebody who just knows some people, but also you just like see it in the data and all the stories, right? Like and all that, like the number one story at the New York Times from, I think it was 2021 was some story about like, how people were just like having deep emotional stress about everything. And there was some word for it. I now forget what the word is. Anyway, that like this is, it's like there's people are just upset about stuff and have been having bad times. And Top Gun Maverick, as you have said, Sonny, I think you thought so more than I, is a very good time. And it is just designed to deliver a good time in a room with a bunch of other people having a good time. And it works pretty well on that front. And so there's something, I think, you know, sort of something really nice about that and something totally appropriate that doesn't need to be coded as right or left, I think, and also doesn't need to be coded as military agitprop. And as somebody who likes movies and who thinks that movies are cathartic and who just enjoys seeing them, and often when I'm having a very bad day or a bad week, seeing even a pretty good movie or occasionally even a terrible movie will just like brighten my mood for a couple of hours, because like sometimes it's fun to hate Morbius. Actually, it was not fun.
Everybody's having fun hating on Morbius.
But it's fun now, right? I'm glad I saw it because it was so bad. I find myself, though, just like the thing that I want to actually sort of say about this is I find myself a little bit on the outside of this. And while I am normally somebody who is like a cheerleader for like movies make life better and they do more than just entertain you for a couple of hours, I didn't get that from this movie. And I think that explains our divergent reactions, where I was the person who didn't hate the movie at all, but liked at least of the three of us. It seemed a little flat to me. It seemed a little bit calculated. And
well,
I didn't,
you're just wrong.
I didn't,
I mean, that's fine.
Catch
it's
whatever
okay
the
wrong.
Fun was that other people were having. I thought this is a lot of impressive flight photography in search of a somewhat better movie. And I'm missing something that other people are seeing in this.
Right, a soul.
But other people are seeing it, and I respect that. And I think it's kind of great that people are finding that from a movie, and in particular, from a theatrically experienced movie. And I think the thing that all three of us will definitely agree on is that's not going to happen on Netflix. That sort of reaction isn't going to be something that you'll get even, you know, from a $250 or $300 million star-studded production on Netflix, because everybody's seeing it at home. And so to me, this is an argument for, even if you didn't feel it yourself, this is like a reminder that, in fact, seeing movies together and going out and doing it with your friends, but also with strangers, is important and like makes our society better.
Alyssa, one thing Peter said, I want to get your opinion on. He says that you don't have to code this as right versus left. And my big takeaway from all of the discussion surrounding this movie is that actually that's wrong, that everything has to be jammed into a right v left box. Is that also kind of how you are reading some of the responses to this? Or is it just me reading all the wrong people?
So I think that what's happening with Top Gun specifically is that a subset of conservatives are trying to claim it and have sort of a better case than usual to make that this movie is popular because it's like pro-America and sort of specifically pro-American competence, which I think is something that is very attractive to people at a moment when two subsequent administrations seem to be just screwing up incredibly badly all of the time. And then people on the left who enjoyed it, not like the Jackman crew because, you know, whatever, no joy there. But people on the left who enjoyed it feel a need to claim it as sort of non-political or make the case that it's not what these conservatives think it is because they want to be able to enjoy it without seeing it as political. But I think more broadly, there's an interesting lesson here about the kinds of movies and TV shows that become fodder for this kind of debate. And I think they fall into two categories. The first is something like Top Gun that is so sort of, it's a reflective surface that's like so smooth and shiny and ideologically contentless that people can kind of project whatever they want onto it. And then there are much sort of messier, sprawling, more detailed stories like Game of Thrones that provide good evidence for any number of possible arguments. And you get very different debates about these two different kinds of things. Like, I don't think, you know, there are not going to be like books of commentary written on Top Gun Maverick. There are not going to be like, there have been sort of some surface level op-eds on it, but there's not going to be like a long intellectual debate about this movie. This conversation cycle will last like 2-3 weeks and then we'll be out. And it doesn't lend itself to a deeper debate, right? Because there isn't that much content there to be parsed. Something like Game of Thrones, you know, lends itself to what I think is best described as just like a nerd style debate, right? Where people are really going sort of deep in the textual analysis. And because there is explicitly a lot to work with there, and we have not had a Game of Thrones style show become popular in the way Game of Thrones was since Game of Thrones has gone off the air. Like there has not been a big textually dense hit like that in the public imagination for a while. And the Marvel movies for a long time kind of were the Top Gun Maverick-y, like, you know, nodding a little bit more at politics even than Top Gun Maverick did, but steadfastly refusing to engage in like a deep way with American politics at all. And so, I mean, I think it's been a while since the op-ed pages have had a new chew toy, like have had a new pop culture chew toy in either of these categories. And so I find the kind of debate that's happening over Top Gun Maverick much less interesting than the sort of Game of Thrones style, like Talmudic textual interpretation debate. But I think it demonstrates that, you know, part of what people are hungry for is something to argue over a little bit, like tussle with and claim and feel invested in. And I think the fragmentation of TV has really, you know, denied us some of those conversations at a time when we kind of needed them.
So you're saying you agree that it's all Netflix's fault? Like that?
Yes,
I mean
everything is like resolved. I've been manifestly on the record that everything is Netflix's fault.
I kind of like Netflix. I kind of like some of the stuff they do, but I do think it's
erroneous.
I am coming. It's not like I ever thought you were wrong, Alyssa, but I am like increasingly coming around to like a deep agreement with you that Netflix is the way that they treat a lot of their properties. Like that just sort of churn everything out and like not give people a chance to process them both themselves and together, and especially together, right? Like This is Netflix doesn't allow sort of communal readings or responses to their work. I won't say not doesn't allow. It wildly disincentivizes communal readings and communal responses to their work. And Top Gun Maverick is the exact opposite. It has encouraged, invited, and been designed in its release strategy and also just like the structure of the way the movie works, right? It's absolutely just there to like hit those nostalgia buttons and like bring you together in like happiness that they finally get in that F-14 that just happens to be sitting outside of the base that they announced like at the beginning of the second act. And then of course the third act, that's the climax, right? It just absolutely hits those buttons, and it is designed to bring people together to like clap with happiness at seeing Tom Cruise fly the thing and like come in at the end. And it is intended to provoke not just like enjoyment in you or like algorithmic clickability, which is what a lot of Netflix does. It is intended to make you happy in the company of other people. And that is something that only big budget blockbuster movies of a certain type can do. And that is the case for Top Gun Maverick and its like value as a cultural proposition.
Exit question for Peter before we get to the real exit question. Do you know, Peter, the only other nation to ever fly the F-14 outside of America? It's a little bit of trivia. Fun little bit of trivia.
I feel like somebody told me this recently, but I do not know.
You know what? It's Iran. fun fact.
Oh, Sonny.
So
you
what
and
we
your
think?
Theories, Sonny. You
what
and
do
your
we think?
Extremely correct theories.
Obviously correct theories. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Top Gun Maverick is the biggest movie of the summer, probably forever, and most explicitly the most conservative, amazing militainment blockbuster of all time? Peter.
It's a small controversy that it has been folded into the left versus right culture wars. It's totally a non-controversy that everybody likes it because even I, who didn't love it, think it's a pretty good movie.
Alyssa.
I think it's controversial to call it the greatest piece of militainment because it does not feature Will Smith punching an alien in the face and saying welcome to Earth. But it is non-controversial that people broadly like it, and also non-controversial that the entirely predictable thing is happening and it's getting op-edded in the absence of anything else to op-ed.
Total non-controversy. This is, in fact, the greatest piece of militainment of all time. The conservatives are right to claim it. It's one of ours. It's ours. Don't try and take it away, libs. All right. On this Friday's bonus episode at atma.thebulwark.com, we're going to offer up some streaming recommendations. I will talk about a Netflix show, contrary-wise to these two haters and doubters of Netflix's greatness. And we'll talk about some other stuff. There's lots of good stuff to watch right now. It's all there. You just got to go find it. We'll help point you in the direction. Speaking of streamers, on to the main event. We Own This City, the latest tale of woe and distress and corruption and heartbreak in the city of Baltimore from David Simon and George Pelicanos. The 6-episode run of which is now ready for you to be watched in full on HBO Max. Right? If Top Gun Maverick is about how awesome America is and how competent it is and how we can still do things, you know, because we're still great. We Own This City, much like The Wire and The Corner before it, is about how terrible America can be when every institution that needs the public's trust fails calamitously and basically simultaneously. I rarely recommend binge watching a show. I don't do that very often because I think most programs do well with some breathing room. It's good to create conversation and also to keep you from zoning out in the midst of one of these binge-style consumption efforts. You know, binging has never been a good term before the whole streaming revolution. I don't know why we're like, oh, binging. Yeah, that's the thing we should do. Anyway,
except when it comes to alcohol.
Yeah, exactly. But what We Own This City is a program that I think you should probably watch over a 2 or 3 night stretch. Thanks to the slightly complicated temporal structure of the show, we hop back and forth over a 15-year or so stretch of life in the Baltimore PD, watching the rise and fall of Dwayne Jenkins, who's played by the great John Bernthal, plainclothes cop who, along with his team, stole just tons and tons of money off of suspects, in addition to stealing drugs to resell on the street. Jenkins' progress is marked by screens representing, I'm pretty sure they're overtime reports, the abuse of which helped Jenkins and his squad literally double their city salaries. But stealing from the city and the citizens, you know, has a price. Can't get away with that. The cops eventually get busted and they rat on each other, leading to prison sentences for all involved. But the rat goes deeper than just the cops on the street, right? We see a mostly honest cop who ends up killing himself rather than face a grand jury to testify about how he may have inadvertently helped Jenkins in one of his drug planting endeavors. We see a police chief who blames all of his failures on his predecessors, who is constantly passing the buck. We see a mayor who doesn't want to pay for the gear to institute the reforms that are necessary and who herself is later indicted for criminal behavior. We see a DOJ that doesn't have any interest in stopping the root problem, all of this, namely the drug war. Basically, every structure has failed, and that failure has led to mistrust of the police, skyrocketing crime rates, institutional corruption up and down the line, and a populace that doesn't have any reason to help the cops, to put people in jail, or to believe that anything will ever get better. Fun times. We Own This City is similar to The Wire in this regard. That was another show about the failure of institutions. But I'll be honest, this feels like a much angrier show than Simon's previous work. The Wire felt almost exhausted by the endlessness of it all, by the kind of horrors of life on the street. There was a almost, I don't want to say nihilistic, but there was an almost, you know, it's never going to get better, so why try? But this one is angry, and this one is angry, and that anger is embodied by Treat Williams, who basically just gives a speech to the camera that's like, okay, guys, the drug war is bad. It is doing all of these things to us, and it is bad. We have to stop this if we're going to stop the things that are happening in this city. We will not be able to stop the things that are happening in this city if we do not stop the drug war. This is only a really very light condensation of what he was getting at. honest people can agree or disagree about the merits of the drug war, and I'm sorry, I really don't think we'd be better off if we were letting people kill themselves with heroin in the gutters while they beg, borrow, and steal the money needed to afford their habit. But we can all agree that Baltimore is the American equivalent of a failed state. It just is. And in large part because the people given the power to execute citizens in the name of the state, the police, have been entirely corrupted. Alyssa, I'm very curious to know what you made of this show, because you have done a series of stories on what we could happily term copaganda, right? The efforts by TV networks to work with the police to kind of shape how citizens view the cops. This is an unsparingly and unstintingly negative portrayal of the police.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. That Treat Williams speech that you mentioned is probably the worst scene in the entire series. And I think in general, the DOJ plotline, which involves, you know, DOJ Department of Justice investigators from the Civil Rights Division coming to Baltimore to do the research necessary to negotiate a consent decree that would essentially be a legal arrangement between the Justice Department and the city of Baltimore to implement a series of police reforms. And unfortunately, they have a nice performance from Wunmi Musaku as Nicole Steele, the Justice Department investigator. But they use that plotline for just the most sort of didactic, obvious stuff in a way that I think The Wire, with its, you know, its longer seasons and multiple season structure, would have let just unfold in a more relaxed and naturalistic way. And so I think that part of the show, the series, does not work and drags the show down sort of overall as a result. But I do think that as a series about how a unit gets corrupted and how crime can flourish within a department, it's pretty fantastic. One thing I wish that they had actually mentioned in the show is that there is a nice example in here of a sort of cyclical relationship between cop entertainment and cop behavior. You probably noticed at one point that some of the corrupt cops refer to their home station as the barn. This was apparently literally a reference to the barn in The Shield, which was the local police station where that show's corrupt cops, like, worked out of. The corrupt officers in Baltimore literally were sort of thinking of themselves and their home base as, like, modeled on Vic Mackey's home station in The Shield, which is amazing. And I think this show is both angry, but it's also kind of a lot of fun in the way it brings together a complex story, right? I mean, the way this whole case, which, you know, is drawn from real-life reporting by the Baltimore Sun, and that refers to everyone in the show by their real names, it gets cracked open by an accident, right? I mean, you have a bunch of cops who are going to retrieve a tracker on a drug dealer's car, and they find a tracker that's owned by other cops who have been tracking that drug dealer so they can rob him. And so the sort of funny spontaneity of that is great. The way that the first episode ultimately reveals that the guys who you've seen rob a drug dealer are in fact cops is just really nicely crafted. And usually there's just a bunch of really fine performances in this. I've been thinking a lot about how John Bernthal went from, you know, a small character actor or someone who I think I probably saw for the first time in The Walking Dead, which I watched for a couple episodes and never really returned to someone who anytime he is in something, I just want to see it, right? And I think it's because he can do such a huge gamut of things as an actor, and you see a lot of them here. He can be scary. He can be charming. He can be sort of rueful and sheepish. You know, he can be disturbing, and he's incredibly versatile. I mean, to go from seeing him as like a kind of floppy-haired tennis coach in King Richard to, you know, a corrupt cop with an equally unfortunate set of haircuts in this show is, you know, it's fun to watch someone come into their full range. And it's also just really delightful to see a bunch of The Wire ensemble come back together in this. So, you know, to have Jamie Hector go from playing Marlo Stanfield to Detective Sean Suter is, you know, just, it's fun to see him get to have that range. To see Delaney Williams go from playing Jay Landsman, the police sergeant on The Wire, to playing Commissioner Kevin Davis here is fun. And I do think, I mean, part of what's interesting about watching this show is that I think the response to it indicates to a certain extent how The Wire influenced the world of television criticism and the conversation about policing in TV, because this is a very tough show about a corrupt unit, but it's also a show about how, you know, certain police and prosecutors are good at their job and are effective, right? I mean, it's an unsparing story about police corruption, but it's also a pretty admiring story about a very effective police investigation. And, you know, I have seen David Simon get some pushback, actually, in response to this series for suggesting that policing can be done better than it often is, and in fact that policing is important. And I think that, you know, the message that a lot of, I think, people in general took away from The Wire is that the drug war is bad, and then you sort of partner that with a racial justice-fueled reckoning about policing that has led some people to the conclusion that, like, all policing is bad, that it's not effective, that it can never be done well. And so in a weird way, I have seen some critics kind of push back on Simon in a way that paints him as the conservative for suggesting that, like, policing can be done well and that, like, neighborhood policing is important.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of fascinating because, I mean, the idea that there was, like, some, you know, bygone heyday of America in which, like, Black Americans and the police were, you know, on buddy-buddy terms and Black communities got the policing they deserved, like, that's fantastical. But there have been periods in American life when the police closed more crimes, for example, like they solved more cases. And so, you know, I think there have been times when the police are more effective, and that Simon in his various shows, you know, is not making an argument for defunding the police, right? He is making an argument that effective policing and prosecution is actually very important.
Well, Simon is not a utopian. I mean, Simon understands that, like, in a city where you have 300 plus murders,
yes,
you need police to keep order. I mean,
just that you need police to keep order, but you need police to maintain some sense of justice in the social fabric, right? I mean, if crimes are not prosecuted, there is a sense of impunity that makes the whole city break down. But also, you know, families who are going to be horribly grieving under any circumstances don't get any sense of resolution or sense that anyone cares about them and is invested in them. And that's not an acceptable state of affairs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the lines of criticism that is an undercurrent of this show is a critique of the officers who refused to do any policing after the Freddie Gray verdict came down because they said they were afraid they would get, you know, arrested, hung out to dry by the slowdown in stoppages, you know, the slowdowns. That is a thing that is critiqued in this. And it's interesting. It's interesting because, as I said, David Simon is not, and George Pelicanos, they're not utopians. They understand the need for police. It's just, you know, policing done bad is bad for everyone.
Right. And I mean, the other through line that's very effective is, and this is, again, a real problem. The number of police officers in Baltimore who could no longer be put on the stand to testify in court cases because they were known to lie. They were known to perjure themselves, or they were so abusive that huge quantities of the population in Baltimore would not believe them. You have that scene in a courtroom where they're trying to seat a jury for a trial and, you know, one guy's been stopped by the police, another guy's had his son locked up, a white guy's been beaten at a Black Lives Matter protest. You know, if the police behave so poorly that you cannot obtain convictions, like, brutality undermines the whole point of policing. If you can't obtain convictions, you might as well not have cops.
Yeah. Peter, what did you make of the show?
I really liked it. I really liked it despite some flaws, some of which Alyssa talked about already, possibly because in a lot of ways, the flaws in this show are flaws that I'm sympathetic to in some ways. David Simon has described the show as a kind of a frontal assault on the drug war. And he's, you know, the show's explicit to it, sometimes to a fault. He's said something to the effect of the message of The Wire was end the war on drugs. And the message here is end the war on drugs, like in all caps with periods, right? He's just making a show that has a very, very clear message that he wants to make sure that you don't miss. And I agree that scene about, you know, well, the drug war, it's just the drug war, is not a great bit of drama.
but awful.
It's not, and it is a weakness of this as a bit of, you know, sort of as a narrative, as a piece of storytelling. But David Simon has other things on his mind beyond just telling the story. I think he wants to deliver a message here. And, you know, so part of the way he does that, and part of what I really, really like about this show, as well as The Wire, is that it's a show about actual police procedure, about the mechanics of police work, the kind of the gritty, sort of ugly, boring, banal details of it, the court appearances, the paperwork, the politics, the incentives for police officers and the incentives for elected officials, the ways those incentives interact with people's personalities and what types of people end up in these particular jobs. I mean, David Simon is under no illusions about who takes, who wants to be mayor in a city like Baltimore. It is not, it is often people who are just sort of weird kind of weird people who desire power and people who desire political power. And, you know, even like in places where things are a little more normal, often kind of odd people who you maybe shouldn't trust with that power. And people who end up in police work are often like probably have predilections towards certain behavioral characteristics as well, even if others, you know, it's not always shared, right? Then what he wants to do is he wants to talk about these incentives, show, not talk about them, but sort of dramatize them and dramatize the way that they break down even very good police, even the ones who might otherwise be making a difference. And so, I think the most affecting story here is Sean Suter's story. It's the character played by Jamie Hector, and he is shown participating in sort of faking evidence when he is on John Bernthal's unit. But then he eventually gets out and he goes on to become a murder detective and is doing good work. But because he is very, like a decade after he helped fake some evidence, not really wanting to, but just because he felt like he had to do the thing that he had to support his fellow officers. A decade afterwards, he's called into a grand jury, and then the show gives us this scene where he ends up with a gunshot wound. And the show strongly suggests that the gunshot wound is self-inflicted. He died from it, that it was self-inflicted and out of desire to get out of the grand jury. This is not something that has been, completely pinned down. It gives us like a title card in the middle of the episode saying there's still people who think that he was actually shot in the line of duty. Obviously, we're not going to resolve that here. But the point is, here is someone who participated in police corruption, was uncomfortable with it, but then went on to become like somebody who was doing valuable police work. And even still, the drug war is haunting him and making it hard for him, putting stresses on him that would have made it hard for him to do his job. And so even good police work is ruined by the drug war. And so this is to me, I am very sympathetic to David Simon's "End the Drug War Now" in all caps with periods message here. Because you talked about how the show is in many ways about how policing can be done well, but often isn't. The message is that policing cannot be done well as long as the drug war is in effect. And I think that's basically right. The demands of the drug war, political and policing, both at like on a granular, like street level and on a political level, make it effectively impossible for police to fully commit to doing their jobs of protecting the citizenry. And the drug war, waging the drug war through police, is not a way of protecting the community. It's a way of sort of scoring political points, it distracts police officers from real police work. And that is the message here that David Simon is trying to sell us on. And like I said, I think, dramatically, not every bit of it works, but a lot of it really does. Many of these performances are just excellent. The procedural aspects of this show are really well handled in that it gives us a sense of not like police work isn't like on like it is like you see it on Law and Order. Police work isn't like you what you see on CSI. Police work isn't even what you see on a lot of other gritty cop shows that are about sort of, you know, the muck of it. Police work is this standardized professional thing that has a bunch of sort of box checking to it, that has just a bunch of like show up and do this, do that, follow orders kind of aspect to it. And when you have a sort of society-wide war on drugs that ends up translating into a kind of a war on a lot of citizens of places like Baltimore, when you have all of these demands, it's very hard for police to do the things that they actually need to be doing. And I think the show makes a pretty powerful case. I also think it's like it's engaging and interesting and entertaining. I wish there were a lot more stuff like this. And this is a show where even with the flaws, I'm willing to excuse them just because it works so well on so many other levels.
Can we do a quick compare and contrast of this and The Wire, which celebrates 20 years since the debut of the first season?
Yeah.
Just recently, I think it was last week or maybe the week before, because I do think, again, the key difference to me in these two series is just how much angrier this is. It's almost like David Simon was like, I tried to tell you guys about this 20 years ago and nobody has listened to me. And this all happened in 2017. This happened, you know, 7 years or whatever after my show went off the air. Why is this still happening? Why is this still going on? It feels to me like the cry of an artist who has not been heeded.
I think that's fair. And I would just say, I mean, I think The Wire is somewhat more artful, though in some sense, it's not a fair comparison because Simon is telling a true story here and is more or less bound to the facts in We Own This City. I mean, obviously there's, you know, some dramatic shaping and compression here, but he's using the real names of the police officers and the many of the characters who are involved and sticking to essentially things that happened. And so there's going to be a limit to how much you can shape that dramatically. But yeah, I think that's right. I mean, and there's a way in which the events of We Own This City prove that the Wire's point was right, but that The Wire didn't go far enough, because the kinds of overt police corruption that we see that actually happened, where a police unit was not just robbing some cash, was not just, you know, lying on the witness stand, was also selling drugs back to the streets, was literally operating as the exact criminal enterprise that they were supposed to be stopping. Like, that's, I mean, in some ways that you saw that artistically presented in the Wire, with its idea that cops and criminals are actually kind of doing the same thing and sort of, you know, right there, there's a yin and yang, a balance between them. But this is, it literalizes a bunch of the ideas in The Wire, and in some ways even goes further about the destructive effects of the drug war on policing and on communities. And I don't know that David Simon's anger is the right vehicle necessarily for producing social change, just in terms of effectiveness. And he's a very cantankerous guy, if you've ever had any or seen interactions with him. I get it. I totally get it. It's got to be infuriating. And I think that We Own the City ends up being, I mean, it's not quite a great work of art, but it's a very, very good dramatic presentation of a social problem.
I mean, I think The Wire is obviously the more significant work of art, but that doesn't mean We Own the City is bad. It's just that The Wire sets an astonishingly high bar. And, you know, I mean, I think that The Wire goes sort of much deeper and broader in terms of developing its characters. Like, one of the things that's interesting about We Own the City is that Simon can clearly draw fairly big name actors now. Bernthal, Josh Charles, who plays Daniel Herschel. Even, you know, someone like Daryl Brett Gibson, who's been doing a lot of good TV work lately. If you haven't watched You're the Worst, he is fantastic and extremely funny in it. And yet he gives them all a lot less to do, right? I mean, Herschel is like is a really interesting character in some ways, and the show just doesn't have room in six episodes to spend time with him and for us to sort of get to know him as a person. And maybe, I mean, for dramatic effect, I can also see having his blankness kind of being an asset to the point that Simon is trying to make. But there's just
on that point, I also suspect it's you don't want to go further than the evidence takes you. And the show doesn't, the show is based on a book. There were about the Gun Trace Task Force. And obviously there's court documents and, you know, investigative materials yeah. here. But if you're portraying a real person, you don't want to sort of invent a psychology and a backstory in the way that, like, if you are inventing a fake police detective as he did, or a fake, you know, drug dealer, you can, sure. you can just sort of go as deep as you want because it's all up to you and you're not in some ways bound by the material.
It's a narrower scope. It's a more limited work. I think there are many fine performances in it. I also think it's quite funny. It, you know, in the way that The Wire often was. I was actually just rewatching the pilot to The Wire today. It's just like the joke density of that pilot is actually quite high. And it's not all like ha-ha funny lines, but it's, you know, the opening scene about the guy who got shot at the dice game. It's like, that scene is hilarious.
Got to, man. This is America.
Right. And it's, but it's also like
incredible punchline for the entire series. 5 minutes
that,
in.
Yeah, unbelievable. And, you know, this is also quite funny, too. There was Sunny, you sent us a couple of screen grabs from the show that just, like, made us all laugh out loud, I think. And, you know, I think this is quite a strong work of fiction, but it's also just the difference between, like, true crime and Dickens, right? Like, and that's, it's okay. It's just, it's a smaller thing, and I'm excited for David Simon to do his next really big thing because I really enjoy David Simon's like big, sprawling, crazy things.
So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on We Own This City? Peter?
Thumbs up. It's very good.
Melissa?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up for me as well. Again, carve out a couple nights. Just watch it in two. You're not going to want to like take big breaks in between this one. You'll have trouble keeping up.
I will suspend my normal binge hatred to agree with Sunny that this is worth binging. It's the equivalent of sitting down and, like, reading a great novel or a good nonfiction book in a couple of settings. Also, highly recommend the original newspaper articles on the Gun Trace Task Force, which you can find on the Pulitzer Center's website if you don't have a Baltimore Sun subscription.
Look at that. All right. That is it for this week's episode. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com. For some streaming recommendations, we're going to be doing some more streaming stuff here, folks. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. We don't grow, we will die. You did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.